You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, July 20th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Jay Cassano, investigative reporter for the International Business Times, on the lobbying efforts behind a massive new arms package for Saudi Arabia, even as Saudi Arabia is devastating Yemen. Who is the former Republican congressman who is also a registered Saudi foreign agent lobbying for this deal, and the Democratic-connected firm that helped ease the path through for advanced weapon sales to the kingdom? And Alex Huckley, journalist and business analyst based in Sao Paulo, on the why of the conviction of President Lula in that country and how a sprawling corruption investigation, which implicates almost all of Brazil's governing class, is being used to limit democracy and attack the left. What happens next in Brazil? Donald Trump, very upset that Jeff Sessions has not read the Constitution and doesn't understand that the job of Attorney General is to help cover up the crimes of a president or something like that. Totally unfair, sad, not right. New bill in Congress would actually criminalize free speech in terms of reality, not something where people get protested at Berkeley or something, but actually would make it so that if you support boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israel, you might end up with a prison term. Shocking piece of legislation. ACLU's come out against it. Some of its main sponsors seem to have no idea what is actually in the bill. And is there going to be yet another push on the GOP's death care package? There are rumblings about this. Tony Blair acknowledging that Jeremy Corbyn may yet become prime minister as his 0-for-3 record with Brexit, Trump, and the UK elections leads him to some electoral awakening, but is the same broken record in terms of advocating 1990s politics and war from the center against the dirtbag left. I will, as a showering member of the dirtbag left, weigh in. All that and more in today's Majority Report. Did you get that Tony Blair sound, Maddie?
It's not on the sound sheet, but we'll have it.
Okay, cool.
You say a showering member of the dirtbag left.
Yes, indeed.
I have a headboard, which is apparently one of the distinguishing things, but that was sort of a recent, like, previous 2 years acquisition of mine.
Yes. I drink Prosecco, and I like to demonize people online. Thank you very much. My wine track dirtbag left. How is everybody doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking.
Kelly, good?
Medium well.
Yeah.
Just pretty like good. She likes her steaks.
Do you like a medium well or medium rare? Or
I
you're
don't
vegetarian?
Eat steak. Yeah.
I'm How long have you been a vegetarian for?
Since I was 11. Mostly, I think I was trying to
pescatarian
annoy
or
my mother. Well, when I was 11, the doctors suggested I eat protein of some sort, so I picked fish. But now, my friend just made me watch this documentary, which I had to stop watching halfway through, and just I'm going vegan. It's over.
What is it? What's
that called? What the Health on Netflix.
What
the
hell?
Available, but oh my god, just I can't.
Indulge me, everybody. I want to just thank. We're at 317 people for the Michael Brooks Show. I appreciate it so much. Thank you. Really sorry. I'm excited about it. We're getting closer and closer to launching it.
I was just kidding. I'm very excited for Michael, too.
Thank you.
If nobody has watched the video that we have up on our YouTube channel of you giving your preview.
Introducing the Michael Brooks Show.
Yeah, I mean, I knew it was happening, and I still haven't really conceptualized. I mean, I guess I just didn't stop and think. But it's really, it's good. It's going to be good.
It's going to be good. Thank you. And everybody should
try. Maybe even great.
I mean, look, in a certain sense. Really quickly, I just want to let everybody know, for everybody who's already signed up, if you get one friend to sign up, because I really want to hit that 500 subscriber mark as soon as possible, and get that $1,000 matching offer from the Angel contributor. So basically what we have is, if you've already signed up on Patreon and you bring one friend over, it's called the it's a plus one program. I will get you a specific voicemail in the, here are the options: Right Wing Mandela, Seb Gorka, Bernie or Bus Bill Clinton, or Nation of Islam Obama. If you go inside the Patreon page and you've already, you're one of the 317, you can go to a specific sign-up page for it. It's really, really easy to do, and it's just a referral program. So get one friend to join, and you will get the message. And thanks, everybody who's gotten us to 317 so far. Really, really exciting what even the first couple of shows are going to be. I've been kind of mapping them out with Matt and with Bashkar and with Anoa and Brian and the sketches, and working on this Third Way history, using an interview from Thabo Mbeki on the ICC.
Working with the MSNBC people so we know what lines to stay inside.
Working with MSNBC people so we know who to shill for and when. And I'm just really excited about it. Being that as it may, let's get to this piece of sound. Donald Trump, for some inexplicable reason, felt the need to speak to the failing New York Times. And
he wants their approval?
Because he desperately wants their approval, because he's a desperately insecure and disturbed person who is careening out of control. And one of the reasons that he's a desperate and disturbed person who's careening out of control is because this Russia thing won't go away. And there was clearly some real miscommunication between him and neo-Confederate Jeff Sessions. And now that miscommunication's coming out in the open, let's take a listen.
Sessions gets the job. Right after he gets the job, he recuses himself.
Was that a mistake?
Well, Sessions should have never recused himself. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me before he took the job, and I would have picked somebody else. Mm-hmm.
He gave you no heads up at all, and then he stopped.
Zero. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Jeff Sessions takes the job.
Takes the job.
Gets into the job. Recuses himself. I then have, which frankly, I think is very unfair to the president. How do you take a job and then recuse yourself? If he would have recused himself before the job, I would have said, thanks, Jeff, but I can't, I'm not going to take you. It's extremely unfair, and that's a mild word, to the president. So he recuses himself. I then end up with a second man who's a deputy.
Okay. So there he is. It's very unfair. Didn't you read the Constitution, Jeff? The job of Attorney General is run interference for the president.
What kind of lawyer are you?
What kind of lawyer are you, Jeff? Mr. President, I thought the point of my office was to resegregate the South and make sure that the wetbacks didn't vote. Yeah, Jeff, that's great for before the election, okay? The South can rise again. I hate Muslims as much as the next guy. They're very scary in homeland. But you're forgetting the prime purpose of the job, Jeff. Protect numero uno. That's Spanish, Jeff.
I agree with you on all the stuff about, stopping black people from voting, and this is all very important. But you know what I do when I get too upset about that stuff is I change the channel, Jeff.
I change the channel. And you know what, Jeff? You know what? I'd appoint a black guy to your job if he protected me from felony investigations. And by the way, I'm not into felonies. That's not my thing. But if I was, I would want an attorney general that protected me. I would. If what was your idea for how Trump could get a spike in approval rating?
Well, I think Trump, I think it would definitely alarm some people, but I think if Trump said, you know, lynching is tough stuff, but we're going to bring back an exception for Jeff Sessions because I'm kind of tired of how he performed as my lawyer. We're going to do one lynching. It's going to be good for the country.
It's going to be healing because if you go back in history, I mean, there are people in the South, they could have been lynched and then they couldn't have gotten a great sandwich at Howard Johnson's, and that was tough stuff. So I think we want to bring it back. We want to heal the country. And Jeff Sessions announced today that he will plan, and maybe we'll play this later, but he will continue serving at the DOJ, and he loves the job. He's announced a new plan on civil forfeiture, which is so invasive of civil liberties that even many conservatives have been speaking out on it. So his primary jobs, as he conceives them, suppressing the vote, unshackling police to do whatever they want, civil forfeitures so that even with very, very limited evidence, if you're involved in any kind of investigation, your belongings can be stripped from you. The job continues, and the president will fume because Sessions apparently forgot his first job, which is, of course, to protect the president from his own probable criminal and certain incompetence.
Worst lawyer ever.
Worst lawyer ever. We'll be right back with Jay Cassano, who's not the worst journalist ever. Not even close. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Sorry about that, folks. Not sure what happened with Jay. We might get him on the other end. But just as importantly here, we actually have an Alex. I apologize in advance. Alex Huckley?
That'll do.
What will do well?
Alex Huckley.
Alex Huckley. Okay. Who is a writer and researcher based in São Paulo, Brazil. And he's a producer and co-host on the Alpha Bunga Bunga podcast. Alex, thanks for being here, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, Alex, it's sort of dropped from the news in the United States, but Brazil has been sort of in a perpetual crisis now for, you know, quite some time, arising out of this sort of sprawling corruption investigation, which seems to do several things at once. It reveals systemic corruption sort of across the political spectrum. It also reveals a judiciary that clearly is using this to target the Workers' Party and target center-left and left forces in Brazil. And now the sort of latest piece of news, we had former President Dilma Rousseff removed from office. And now former President Lula has actually been convicted. And he really was the sort of leading candidate heading into the 2018 election. Leading up to his conviction, can you kind of work the investigation backwards and explain what this kind of larger car wash scandal is and how we got where we are and the state of play now?
Yeah, I mean, I can totally appreciate that from abroad, Brazil is quite hard to follow because the cast of characters and the different power bases and the competitions that's going on makes it pretty hard to get a grasp on, even if you're living here. And there's the Brazil's ongoing crisis. It's something it's been going on for 4 years, and the car wash investigation is only one third of it, let's say, because there's also an economic crisis going on and a wider political popular mobilization, which exploded onto the scene in 2013, which is before the car wash investigation started and before the economic crisis really hit Brazil. So you've got all these parts. But let me just, to your question, I'll talk about the car wash investigation. Yeah. It started in 2014, and it was it started at a car wash where there was some money changing hands, and that investigation then exploded to taking whole sections of the political class, based around kickbacks between contractors, politicians, and Petrobras, the major oil, state-owned oil company in Brazil. But as that proceeded, it seemed to be really targeting the Workers' Party. Of course, the Workers' Party were in government at the time, but as is become pretty evident to everybody, this corruption is very widespread and totally across the board in the political class. But it caught the popular imagination. It had very widespread support, and it led to big protest demonstrations on the street throughout 2015, especially as of 2015 and 2016, which became very hostile to the Workers' Party and identified the Workers' Party with corruption. Mm-hmm. And it created this impression that it was the Workers' Party which somehow had created this corruption scheme, that Brazil was kind of not corrupt beforehand. The Workers' Party comes in and creates this scheme, which to any impartial observer is completely fanciful. I mean, I don't think that's a credible position at all. But that anti-corruption movement on the streets, which I think has to be recognized was pretty middle class, upper middle class, and even had the support of many leading politicians who now have themselves fallen foul of the anti-corruption investigation. Including the current president, including the defeated 2014 presidential candidate, Aécio Neves, who was the darling of the center-right at the time. He was photographed at the anti-corruption demonstrations, and then, of course, now he's fallen foul of it. He's even been photographed as well with Sergio Moro, the investigating judge. Right. So it seems like a complete mess, and everybody's in each other's pockets. And in some ways, this has led to the political class sort of falling apart. Mm-hmm. But what's led to Lula's conviction? I mean, they arrested Lula in March of 2016, but without charge, and then released him, which was a bit of a media coup. There's been a lot of media spectacle about the whole car wash investigation, and lots of selective leaks to the media, again, always targeting the Workers' Party. That's right. Not to say that the only politicians and the only businessmen who've been arrested and convicted have been associated with the Workers' Party. That's not true, but it has largely focused on the Workers' Party.
Mm-hmm. So does it, and let's, you know, get specifically to, the kind of larger currents you're talking about, the economic and the political crisis. But it seems to me, and you would know this better than me, but I'm curious how this reads to you, because when Lula became president, which is already now, I think he was elected in 2002 or 2003.
Yeah.
So this is a long time ago at this point. He had been a candidate several times before. He was known nationally in Brazil as a labor union leader and a founder of the Workers' Party, which was a party clearly of, you know, at the very least, the social democratic left. And by the time he was elected president, he really seemed a kind of synthesis figure, in the sense that he did not, he moved to the quote unquote center, but he was still very identified with the left. He did introduce some very progressive social programs. He did take some of the benefits of the Brazil's commodity boom, which really accelerated during his presidency, and invest them into social programs and other sort of areas to deal with the inequality crisis in Brazil. And then at the same time, he reached out to international lending institutions. He promoted Brazilian businesses, and he cut deals with other Brazilian parties as well. And it seemed, and it's what's fascinating is that this was covered in the particularly United States press as an example of him moderating and him moving to the center. And my read of kind of like looking at the scandal, you know, sort of in reverse, and maybe there's, you know, personal enrichment or whatever else. I couldn't really comment on that. Maybe you will. But it seems like what was initially covered as, oh, this is a, you know, a left-wing firebrand kind of moderating. Well, this is what it means in Brazil to quote-unquote moderate. It means like, okay, we'll trade you social programs for essentially continuing a lot of very old pre-existing relationships and crony capitalist practices. And now the right in Brazil over the last couple of years kind of grew tired of that compact. And now they're using, you know, the instruments of judiciary and media to get rid of Dilma and Lula, which again doesn't, you know, it's not exculpatory of them. They could very well have been involved in corruption, but that's my kind of general read of it.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I wouldn't disagree with a lot of that. They, Lula, you know, the, what was the PT originally back, you know, in the 80s and the 90s was a party which broke with the mold of both kind of European social democracy as well as the communist parties by being an alliance of labor unions, social movements, and kind of radical Catholic churches. But he did moderate in especially in the lead up to the 2002 election. He famously wrote this letter to the Brazilian people in which he promised that, which is really a letter to international finance, if we're honest, right, promising that he wouldn't rock the boat too much. And in power, he did, you know, if you look at who he appointed to key ministries, it was a real mixed bag. So, you know, the Ministry for sort of Industrial Development would have been gone to someone more left wing, whereas in the Treasury, it would have been someone who was a kind of a dyed-in-the-wool neoliberal. So you had this kind of balancing act going on, and it was called, you know, class conciliation. I mean, that's the rubric under which the PT governments have been understood. And over that, and it's interesting if we remember back to 2002, Lula was elected on the slogan of "Little Lula, Peace and Love," which is pretty anodyne. And doesn't really speak to really being a sort of socialist firebrand. And generally, I think when people on the left tend to run on more centrist tickets, they tend to actually govern in that way. I mean, this idea that, you know, they're going to sneak in and once they're in power, then they'll implement a really radical agenda, I mean, rarely happens. And indeed, that's what came to pass in Brazil. The commodities boom allowed the Workers' Party to, you know, create or expand social programs, which took 40 million people out of poverty and so on. But the cost of that was doing business in the old ways of doing business in Brazil, which is to say lots of kickbacks, deals with contractors, bribes, and all the rest of it. The first scandal which emerged was in 2005, called the kind of Big Monthly scandal, in which they were paying bribes to congressmen. So, I mean, it depends how you look at things. Some people say, well, this is a worthwhile cost to bear, the old ways of doing politics in exchange for, you know, improving the lot of a lot of Brazilians.
Right.
And a lot of people and, you know, Lula left office as the most popular politician in the whole world.
He had an 83% approval rating. And that's, you know, an actual number. It's this. We're not talking like Gaddafi or Assad or something. That's an actual number enormously popular. And to be clear, I think just to underscore that, leaving office, we're not talking about, you know, coming in as some kind of, you know, charismatic figure that people are excited about. After two full terms, he's leaving at 83%. And then pretty much, you know, Dilma, who's, you know, very smart and very accomplished, but had no electoral political experience and wasn't particularly charismatic, essentially was, you know, given a third term almost, you know, very much due to Lula's overwhelming popularity.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, these are kind of like world historic levels of popularity. And Lula retains a lot of popularity, but he's also a very divisive figure. If you look at all the polling, his rejection levels are very, very high. Mm-hmm. But you know, he also has a lot of support. But a lot of this is also based on who Lula is, where he came from, coming from the poor Northeast, becoming a union leader, being seen as a man of the people. And this is in the context of a Brazil still ruled by very much an old elite. I mean, the idea of any sort of meritocracy is like pretty laughable in Brazil. And so for that reason, he's come to take on and embody something much larger than himself.
Right.
That ends up presenting a certain problem to the left today in Brazil, and that he's kind of seen as a savior figure, able to concoct political success out of nothing, which I just don't think is the case. I mean, today Brazil is in such a deep economic crisis, which cannot simply be resolved by a little bit more state investment and so on, which I think might be Lula's program for, you know, running the 2018 elections.
Okay, so this is all happening in the context now. We should say that the current president, Michel Temer, who took over after removing Rousseff, he's implicated in his own, and we should say, I would say specifically, in contrast with Rousseff, much more serious corruption allegations aimed at him specifically than there was ever aimed against Rousseff, right? Then there's also new sort of attacks on labor unions, and there's been sort of, you know, a mass protests around that. When you talk, and then you're saying that Lula is not necessarily talking about running in 2018 on a particularly strong anti-austerity agenda, but kind of just a return to the good old days and his own personal charisma. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I guess the bigger question is that is the lesson to the Brazilian left that we extended this big olive branch, which is that basically the kind of like core relationships can still kind of basically exist in the in Brazilian politics and the Brazilian oligarchy, but the rewards need to be somewhat redistributed to actually improve quality of life for the country and do something about poverty. Now, this is contrasted with, you know, and obviously there's, you know, there's crisis in Venezuela. You know, this kind of pink tide has had a lot of problems, but certainly other, you know, governments in the region came to power on much more kind of adversarial platforms to existing power structures. Lula did a third way and kind of split the difference. And if still it's unacceptable to Brazil's elite, I mean, what is the message to the left out of that? I'm not saying obviously Venezuela is not the answer, but at the same time, is it, you know, we got to get back to, you know, metaphorically speaking, the barricades.
Absolutely. I think we have to be very explicit about this, actually. The model of class conciliation, which the PT worked under over the 2000s, is no longer possible. It's a complete fantasy. If we roll back, what made the conditions which made what is called Lulismo possible was the global commodities boom, and which allowed some very rich people in Brazil to get even richer. So for all that the lot of the poor improved in Brazil, the lot of the very rich was even, you know, by several degrees of magnitude bigger.
Right.
As soon as that show started to come apart because of the end of the commodities boom, the global financial crisis eventually hitting Brazil, albeit in a delayed fashion, the elite were like, okay, let's pull the plug on this. We're not willing to do business with them anymore. And yet they couldn't win an election. They couldn't win the presidency anymore. Right. They were defeated in 2002, in 2006, in 2010 by Dilma Rousseff, and again in 2014, an election they thought they had in the bag.
Right.
Immediately after the election, there was already talk of how do we get rid of this government? We cannot believe we've lost again. How do we somehow overturn this? And the deep economic crisis created a disgruntlement. There was the explosion of the 2013 protests, which I think nowadays we kind of forget about, and it's maybe not so discussed abroad. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there was an explosion in June 2013 of popular protest, which was really demanding more democracy, better public services,
right.
Created by a sense of rising expectations over the past decade, but which hadn't really been matched by, you know, public services. Those protests were, over the course of a year or two, channeled rightwards to a very narrow anti-corruption discourse, which really targeted the PT.
Right.
And a lot of sections of the elite, led by corporate media, basically created an agenda which was the PT has to go. They've created this massive corruption. They're responsible for the economic crisis, and they have to be gotten rid of. In Congress, they seized on opportunistically on the idea of impeachment, of impeaching Rousseff, right, which eventually came to pass last year. And that impeachment was, I mean, you know, just really scarcely legitimate. There's still an impression, I think, that she was impeached for corruption. She wasn't. It was for a minor, you know, fiscal maneuvering, which everyone at governor level, at federal level does all the time, you know, kind of something you don't bat an eyelid at. But of course, she'd lost support in Congress, and her old allied base had deserted her. And, you know, this ended up with her impeached and her vice president, who comes from a totally different party, from this centrist, you know, amalgamation PMDB party. Mm-hmm. And he came in. This we talk about now as being, you know, the parliamentary coup. And it's a real epochal moment, yeah, in Brazil, because it really kicked Brazilian democracy into the gutter. Mm-hmm. And the consequence of this was that Temer came in and implemented really drastic neoliberal reforms, which are continuing to pass. Attacks on labor rights, attacks on pensions, what a constitutional amendment has already passed, freezing spending for 20 years, the most drastic sort of measure anywhere in the world. I think the nearest thing that was passed was maybe in the Netherlands, where they put a cap for like 3 or 5 years. Right. So, you know, this is world historic level.
It's like an ultra far right agenda. And then also completely reversing in terms of cabinet appointments, the progress that the PT had made in terms of racial and gender representation as well. I mean, they really,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, not that that's the be all and end all, but it is an important symbolic factor in a country which is, you know, 50% black and so on, where you had a cabinet of old white dudes.
And
you know, it was very obvious to everyone what was going on there. And, you know, I think when we talk about the parliamentary coup, this wasn't to depose a kind of left-wing regime. This isn't the kind of Cold War model where it's like a left-wing, maybe communist or nationalist regime which is in power, which the right comes in and sweeps them out of power through legitimate means. You know, this was like a kind of a center-left government, which a lot of the elite felt, certainly the more kind of the sort of domestic capitalists felt that they could do business with until they felt that they couldn't anymore. But what really marks it as something more than just, let's say, palace intrigue is the fact that the program implemented by the Temer government, these austerity measures, is a very significant deviation from what the PT was doing in power. For all that it ruled in a fairly orthodox manner, the degree and depth of austerity that is being pursued by this government is really, you know, eye-watering.
Yeah, and I mean, basically and I have a final brief two-part question, but I mean, just to really underline it would be like if Republicans impeached Obama on a technicality for basically like something in terms of, disputing the way a number was presented in the budget. That's really basically what Rousseff was impeached over. And then they impeached him, removed him from office, and then led a constitutional convention under the direction of the Koch brothers to have a balanced budget amendment and phase out social programs. I mean, that's essentially what's happening in Brazil. And you know, so the kind of final two-part question, I mean, is there a left that can rise to this task that sort of exists in that more independent space? And connected to that, because regardless in some ways of the performance of the PT, they are still the kind of, you know, Rousseff and Lula have been so relentlessly attacked and the victims of this kind of parliamentary coup. Can Lula's popularity and just innate political skills be utilized by a resurgent left, or are those two entirely divergent strands?
Look, I mean, as to the left's prospects, I guess my mood on this changes day to day. And, you know, it seems to be the level of mobilization sometimes seems really high. So there was a general strike back in April, which was a real remarkable achievement. Some 40 million Brazilian workers went on strike, maybe one third of the total workforce, which was a real achievement. And it felt like, OK, finally, here is the Brazilian working class responding to these attacks on it. And there's also some very big demonstrations, both in São Paulo and Brasilia, all around the country in small towns as well. And then it seemed to dissipate. And there's been, since the impeachment, since the parliamentary coup, there's been these waves, these ups and downs. And to a certain extent, the Brazilian population is exhausted. There's been 4 years of mobilization. There's very severe, Brazil's most severe recession ever. So the degree to which that mobilization can be maintained consistently is really under question. And what's really required is a level of leadership. But there isn't a totally clear agenda. What the protests have mobilized around has been resistance to the reforms and calling for new direct elections, which is very important and as good as far as it goes. But perhaps it doesn't have the capacity to inspire because it doesn't really set out a program for lifting Brazil out of the hole that it's found itself in. I think what is really remarkable in kind of really world terms is that the elite itself is completely falling apart. It used to have a much higher level of cohesion or at least of kind of intra-class solidarity. Now that seems to be completely falling apart and they're all at each other's throats. Because partly it's divided between the sort of old elite, which is very clientelistic and so on, and a younger section of modernizing elites who are perhaps more explicitly neoliberal, but who also are more Annette put this in quotation marks, anti-corruption, and who really cheerled the car wash investigations as a way of getting rid of the old clientelism. So you might have this more modern, internationally oriented elite coming to power. They're at each other's throats, and I think a lot of in Brazil will be determined by who wins that, absent any kind of left force. But I mean, you know, to ask to the question of the left, I think the problem is that Lula still dominates the imagination of a lot of the left, and he won't be able to resolve these issues because he, firstly, is compromised insofar as he has made noises that he won't really reverse a lot of these reforms. He'll come in, maybe, you know, tidy around the edges a little bit and soften the blow, but he's not going to really reverse what the Temer government has done. And so I think personally, one might want to defend Lula against the persecution. But at the end of the day, if he's guilty, he's guilty. I don't think that should be really the focus of left organizing. So right now, the real task is kind of trying to come together, formalize a program. But in terms of actual individual leaders, there really aren't very many out there in Brazil today.
Well, Alex, I appreciate your time. Alex Huckley is a writer and business analyst based in São Paulo. He also is the co-host of the At Alpha Bunga Bunga podcast, which I think has something to do with Italy. That's all I'll say. Alex, I appreciate your time, Alex. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, everyone. We are going to give Jay one more shot. And supposedly there's a different line that he's available on, and we'll do that now. We'll be back in a few seconds. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Jay Cassano. He's a investigative journalist for the International Business Times. His new piece, Lockheed, Saudi Arabia Arms Deal, pushed by former Republican lawmaker who represents both sides. And when he says both sides, he means Lockheed and Saudi Arabia, not like Lockheed and something good. Jay... There's a lot of energy for this interview in the office. There's this like outbreak. I hope I don't get sick, guys. Jay, there's a former congressman named Howard Buck McKeon. He seems like almost a caricature of Washington corruption. And not, you know, in the legal sense. It's in fact, it's even more shocking because all of this is in fact entirely legal. Utter moral cravenness, and really the mechanics of how things get done. I mean, right now we know in Saudi Arabia they've been conducting a brutal air campaign against Yemen for the past several years now. It was sort of a gift in some ways. The Obama administration basically seemed to be like, all right, look. We've pissed Saudi off enough with Iran and several other motions that we've sort of proceeded with in the Middle East. So let them just take care of, you know, do what they want to do in Yemen, even if they're committing war crimes. And then under the Trump administration, we have a brand new arms deal with Yemen that got pushed through Congress. How did it happen? And who is this guy, Buck McKeon? And how did he help make it all happen?
Yeah, I mean, you're right that, you know, the scandal here is basically what is actually legal and the fact that none of this breaks any laws. The short version is that this former Republican Congressman Buck McKeon, and you're right, I really do love saying his name, has helped secure over $1 billion in arms sales for Saudi Arabia, which is waging this devastating war on Yemen. And McKeon is a registered lobbyist for both major defense contractors like Lockheed Martin and a registered foreign agent of Saudi Arabia. So just to zoom out quickly on, on the war, at least 5,000 Yemeni civilians have died directly from the fighting, and you have another 5,000 that have died from secondary consequences of the war, like famine and preventable diseases. Since late April, according to statistics from human rights organizations, at least 1,700 people have died from cholera. Cholera is a disease that the World Health Organization says is easily treatable. And Saudi Arabia is basically blockading aid from reaching Yemen. And so people are dying from these easily treatable diseases.
So how does a guy like Buck, you know, and right now, you know, the kingdom is a controversial subject in Washington, partially because some people, not nearly enough, are concerned about human rights. The horrific travesties of what Saudi Arabia, along with refueling support with the United States and the UK, is doing in Yemen. And then there's also a kind of broader conversation about, you know, particularly in light of the, you know, blockade on the Qataris, of, well, wait a second. Actually, if we're concerned about terrorism issues and extreme, you know, sort of Wahhabi violence, Saudi Arabia and the kingdom should be at the top of that conversation. Buck McKeon has not only lobbied for this deal, but actually made sure that provisions, as an example, Congressman Ro Khanna tried to put in to stipulate rules around what can be sold to Saudi Arabia or not sold to Saudi Arabia. He's lobbied across the board, not just for the overall package, but for any type of mitigating factor on what can be sold to the kingdom. So I guess I'm curious about the overall package and what kind of weapons we're kind of talking about. And then how McKeon helped overturn these sort of very, very sensible and modest limits that someone like Khanna was trying to put on this deal.
Right. So there are sort of three pieces to this puzzle of what he's been doing for Saudi Arabia since a week after President Trump was elected, which is when he registered as a foreign agent of the Kingdom of Saud. So the first piece is there was a $500 million sale of precision-guided munitions to Saudi Arabia that was narrowly approved mid last month. If you were following the headlines, it got a lot of traction in New York Times and The Atlantic. You know, this close vote, 53-47, and basically, you know, precision-guided munitions—they sound like a good thing, I guess, in the context of war, that you can strike the target you intend to actually strike, and you know, avoid, you know, hit military targets, avoid civilians. But in the context of Saudi Arabia, basically it just means they're turning around and really making sure that they're hitting the schools, hospitals, and markets that they want to hit. So what McKeon did is, according to his foreign agent disclosures, he spoke to at least 7 Republican senators about the arms sale leading up to this vote mid last month. And 6 of the 7 senators that he spoke to voted to allow the sale. And now, you know, you can do the basic math. The vote was 53-47. So he likely secured that vote and possibly flipped it from crumbling. It's important to know that support for Saudi Arabia, like you said, has been really crumbling over time. The last time an arms sale like this came up for a vote, the vote was something more like 76-24, or something much easier to get through. So that was the first piece. The second piece is this recently announced $600 million contract for Sikorsky helicopters, Black Hawk helicopters. And those helicopters normally, you know, I don't know if you watched any bad war movies like Black Hawk Down or whatever, but you know, they're often used for airlifting troops, evac situations, that kind of stuff. But the model that Sikorsky sold to Saudi Arabia is their, I think it's the UH-60M, which is a utility model that can be outfitted with weapons for airstrike capabilities.
Right.
So it can fill multiple roles, and it's possible that it's going to contribute to this devastating air assault on Yemen. Sikorsky is a wholly owned subsidiary of Lockheed Martin. And McKeon doesn't just lobby for the foreign governments like Saudi Arabia. He also lobbies for defense contractors like Lockheed Martin. And it's important to know, you know, going back in his congressional career, serving 22 years as a congressman from California, the last four of which he was the chair of the House Armed Services Committee,
right,
which basically, you know, it sets a lot of the policy for the Department of Defense. You know, throughout the course of his career, his five biggest donors were all defense contractors, Lockheed, Boeing, General Atomics, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman. And, you know, they gave him over $700,000 over the course of his career, which is a lot for a congressman. Remember, we're not talking about senators or presidents here.
Right.
So, you know, and in fact, you know, to dive into his history a little bit, defense contractors loved him so much that when his wife, Patricia, was running for California State Assembly, an interesting thing happened, and they started donating to her, which is
right,
kind of rare for huge defense contractors to be interested in a state assembly race. So, you know, it was kind of viewed as like a thank you from the defense contractors to Buck.
Thanks, Buck.
You know, you could also see it as a way for them to kind of funnel more money to Buck and avoid the normal campaign finance limits by saying they're giving it to his wife's campaign.
Well, without, maybe she'll introduce a resolution in the California Assembly that says that the state of California,
sure,
backs Saudi Arabia in committing horrific human rights travesties to anybody that lives in a Houthi-controlled area in Yemen. Because, I mean, just to kind of take it out for a second, the reason that Saudi is so relentlessly punishing of civilian populations is it's sort of the Gaza model, which you want to punish people who live under who they want to dislodge,
right,
essentially. So the other piece of this here, besides Buck, is, you know, and of course, you know, getting, in fact, securing this bill, you know, relied on Democratic votes like Joe Manchin as an example. So, you know, Buck McKeon also works closely with a firm that now is bipartisan, but was founded by Clinton Gore alums. It's called Glover Park Group, and it's a firm that was co-founded by Michael Feldman, who was a Gore aide, and Joe Lockhart, who was Bill Clinton's press secretary. Glover Park is more, I think, does lobbying, but they're more in the kind of like crisis communications PR side of things.
How does
Glover fit into this and this kind of supply chain of influence peddling?
Yeah. So going back to that $500 million precision guided munition sale, Glover, 5 days before the vote, distributed, you know, these propaganda materials to the Senate on behalf of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, basically saying, you know, you need to be sure to allow arms sales to Saudi Arabia because otherwise the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels are going to take over and, you know, chaos ensues from there. So Glover worked to ensure that arms deal. They also worked on this that piece of legislation you referred to with the amendments from Ro Khanna, which I'll get back to in a second. So Glover Park was very involved with that as well. And, you know, basically, what happened there is there's an annual law that's passed called the National Defense Authorization Act, or the NDAA.
Right.
And, you know, your listeners might be most familiar with the NDAA when in 2012 it was used to authorize indefinite detention of American citizens in counterterrorism contexts. But the NDAA basically sets the annual budget and policies for the Department of Defense. And it's important to this story because there are a host of amendments that were introduced to this year's NDAA that were meant to block or limit arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And they weren't just from Democrats like Ro Khanna. You also have Republicans like Justin Amash, you know, from the sort of libertarian isolationist wing of the Republican Party, who are introducing amendments. Amash wanted to block, I believe, cluster munitions from being sold to Saudi Arabia, which they've been using to devastating effects. And they're really horrible
And I
weapons.
Do believe that that's a shift from Obama to Trump. you know, in the sort of classic. I think Obama administration didn't approve of those to Saudi, but I would need to double check that.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the status of that is, because they're technically banned in war, but Saudi Arabia is still using them in Yemen.
Right.
And I think it's not entirely clear where they're coming from, but I'm not 100% sure about that. So basically, there are a host of these amendments to the NDAA, which, to be clear, they haven't been brought down yet. They're still on the table. They were just introduced recently. But McKeon and Glover Park are already working, lobbying on the NDAA on behalf of Saudi Arabia. And it's not just Saudi Arabia, but also McKeon's domestic lobbying clients like Lockheed Martin. It all comes full circle. So basically, we have Buck McKeon lobbying on the NDAA on behalf of Lockheed. You have Glover Park Group lobbying on the NDAA on behalf of Saudi Arabia. And you have Buck McKeon lobbying Congressman Mac Thornberry on behalf of Saudi Arabia. And Thornberry is McKeon's successor as chair of the House Armed Services Committee, which is the committee responsible for reviewing the NDAA. So basically, I've talked to a lot of people in Washington, and you know, I reviewed all the NDAA amendments myself, and really the only interest that Saudi Arabia could conceivably have in U.S. defense policy is to make sure that these kinds of amendments restricting sales to their country don't pass. And of course, Lockheed has a vested interest in that as well. Lockheed has, to be fair, a lot of other interest in the NDAA because that's their whole business.
Right.
But they also have interest in making sure that restrictions on the countries that they can sell to don't pass. So you have Buck and Glover Park going at it from all sides to make sure that the roads are clear for Saudi arms deals. I mean, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to call him an arms dealer. He's essentially making sure that his client on the one hand can get arms and his client on the other hand can sell arms.
I would call him a war crimes facilitator.
A profiteer off war profiteers.
Right. So, final question. I'm assuming no any response from Glover Park Group or Buck McKeon on this story?
Not yet. I was getting scheduled to have a call with Mr. Buck McKeon and his secretary asked, "Oh, can you tell me one more time what this is regarding?" And you know, I said, "Oh, it's about his lobbying on behalf of Saudi Arabia," and it was put on hold for a second. And she comes back on a couple minutes later. Yeah, we'll take a no comment on that.
right. Sounds
so,
about
no
right.
Yeah.
Well, it's a very important piece, and it really, I mean, I think, you know, there's also, because there's so many things that are, there are some things that are happening that are exceptional and disgusting and kind of breathtaking with Trump, but this is the type of story that has been going on for decades. I mean, this is the old traditional bread and butter of kind of bipartisan, just sort of Washington grotesqueness, and it's very well reported. Jay Cassano, Lockheed, Saudi Arabia arms deal pushed by Republican former lawmaker who represents both sides, by Jay Cassano in the International Business Times. Jay, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. All right, everybody, we are going to move to the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report. Go to podcastawards.com to nominate Majority Report for Best News in Politics.
Make us win, guys. Come on. We haven't won one since me and Kelly have been here.
Yeah. And frankly, it's getting a little uncomfortable around here.
I mean, we weren't eligible, but I am still annoyed about it.
I want to win, goddammit. And Matt is, I've never
I'm
seen
very
Matt
competitive
worked
person.
Up about anything. I get that. I appreciate that. Obviously, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, the IMs are on, and we will see you in the fun half.
situation say? She said, no, 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 no. Things are looking bad. She said, no, 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 no. And if it was a